Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Shelton Copperell, who is a professor here at Grand Valley State University. Our subject was anti-Semitism, and we continue with that line of thinking today. A bit about Sheldon, as I mentioned, he is a professor here at Grand Valley State University, and he has been one since 1970, and he's retiring after 40 years. However, he still will maintain a relationship here at the school. He is a member of the Biomedical Sciences and Liberal Studies departments. His subjects include history of science, art history, and of most relevance, Judaism and Introduction to Religious Studies. He serves as a lay adult and religious school educator at Temple Emmanuel here in Grand Rapids. And when the rabbi is unavailable, he will lead the weekly Torah study group and has on occasion conducted Friday evening services. He is also a member of the board of directors at our Interfaith Dialogue Association here in Grand Rapids. So I welcome to Common Threads my colleague and friend, Shelton Copperell. Hi, Shelton.
Hi, Fred. Good to be back with you.
Thank you. Thank you. So last week, we talked quite a bit about your childhood, about anti-Semitism as you experienced it yourself in the 1940s and 50s. We also got into a little bit of the politics of that day. And today, let's talk about anti-Semitism as we see it today. And I want to start off because, you know, we could talk about the right for the rest of this show and maybe even an extra one. But a lot of people tend to forget that the extreme left can be rather anti-Semitic. And before you answer, I'm sure you will make this clear. Arguing against Israeli policies is not necessarily anti-Semitic, but it can be. So approach it from that angle.
Yes, I think that a lot of people like to use the excuse, if I may use that term, that a lot of the policies of the Israeli government, particularly the Netanyahu government that's run for the last several years, are not to their liking, and that Israel has become, certainly during these times, a almost counter to what the original aims of the Israeli state and the ideals of most Jews, certainly here in America, and Israelis, was in the beginning in 1948 when the State of Israel was created. And because of some of the, what I regard as abuses of the Netanyahu government, settlements, some hardline occupation of the West Bank, and certainly a refusal to give any grounds on some issues like Jerusalem, a lot of people who are more anti-Semitic have taken the tack that they, by fighting the policies of the Israeli government, are not anti-Semitic, they're just anti-Israel. And I'm sure that some of these people are possibly only concerned about the Israeli government, the backers of, for example, the boycott movements and the supporters of UN resolutions condemning Israel. But a lot of the people who have numbered themselves in that crowd, I feel, are really down deep, more than anti-Israeli, that they really do have problems with Judaism and Jews because they are Jewish, not because of this connection with Middle East politics. And I should make a point that I've brought up. I just yesterday gave two lectures in one of my colleagues' Introduction to Middle East Studies classes about Judaism. And it's my firm belief that Islam and Judaism have so much more in common as far as religions are concerned, that they are probably two closely related religions, and that the problems that we have in the Middle East are largely politics. That religion-wise, Jews and Muslims have much we can agree on. And in our interfaith dialogues, as you know very well, we find lots that we have as common grounds to go on. So my own view is the origin of the Middle East situation, and I won't elaborate any further. If you want to trace it back, it can be traced to the fact that as World War I was coming to an end in 1917-1918, the British government, preparing to take over the remains of the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, particularly in the western territories, Palestine and Israel, promised land to both the Jews, the Balfour Declaration, thanking Chaim Weizmann, a chemist, for his contributions to the war effort. Incidentally, Weizmann became the first president of the State of Israel, and also thanking the Arabs, famous Lawrence of Arabia, for helping the British fight the Ottoman Turks as World War I was coming to a close, and they promised, another part of the British government promised them land in the same territory. So if you really want to, in that sense, look for a fall guy, I would go back to the British government of that time. I'm not trying to say anything about the current British government, but history has a strange way of being forgotten among people today.
No, we get that, and they did the same fine job in Israel Palestine as they did in Pakistan India.
Certainly, and almost the same time.
Exactly. So this anti-Semitism that you see that sometimes disguises itself as purely anti-Israeli government, what do you look for to see that? What in their stands, in their rhetoric, indicates to you, no, this is just a little bit more than being frustrated with a particular prime minister?
And that's it exactly, the frustration with the prime minister, the frustration even with the Israeli government for many years, certainly since 1967, since the Six-Day War, which occurred, by the way, almost exactly 50 years ago, was the arguments of the people who are anti-Semitic tend to go beyond that. There's something inherently arrogant, I think is as good a word as any, of the Jews, as represented by the Israelis, that they think that they have the right to lord it over the other people in the neighborhood. And in the mind of the anti-Semite, that goes back to the concept of the chosen people. This is something that's bothered a number of thoughtful Jews, including my wife and myself, for a number of years. We talk about, or some people talk about, the Jews as the chosen people because, according to the Bible, it was God who visited Abraham, the founder of the three Abrahamic faiths, and chose him and his descendants to receive the covenant, the promise of the land. And what makes you so special? Now, there's lots of different explanations about that, but we believe that the thing that makes the Jews the chosen people, in a sense, is that we hold the burden, and it is a burden, of bringing social justice to the world. That we are, as Isaiah says, a light unto the nation, or we should be a light unto the nations. And admittedly, there are some members of the Jewish community who take that way too far and do perhaps arrogantly claim to be better than other people. Most of the Jews that I know, in fact, virtually all the Jews that I know, don't hold that view at all. My wife, when she was attending religious school back in Milwaukee, where she grew up, was taught that the Jews were perhaps the choosing people. They chose to accept this burden, this yoke of responsibility. So I think that a lot of the anti-Semitism has been brought into the Israeli government because of the behavior, perhaps, of some of the members of that government. and that this then is expanded, extrapolated, as it were, to include all Jews and all professions. And these people point to the fact that there are a number of Jews who are influential advisors, and we get such catchphrases as Jews control government, Jews control the media, etc., etc. Ironically, again, talking about an irony, if Jews control the media, why is the state of Israel on the receiving end of so much negative publicity? Interesting question.
That is a very good question. I'm glad you brought up some of those myths, those slanderous statements about Jews controlling this, controlling that. I know a lot of 20th century anti-Semitism has its foundation in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Yes.
A piece of fiction that really, really got some legs and still has legs today. It's absolutely astounding. But clearly, this is fiction. Remind us of what's included in this, if you
certainly would. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion was a totally fictionalized statement allegedly written by the International Jewish Conspiracy, that is, people from all parts of the world who happen to be Jewish, to try to control, to take over stealthily or more overtly control of the world. And these elders of Zion, of course, is the term that's used in the Bible for one of the names for the city of Jerusalem, the city of David. And in 1897, a Zionist movement was formed in Switzerland originally under the leadership of Theodor Herzl, who, recognizing anti-Semitism in a number of places in Europe, including France, which right then was undergoing the Dreyfus case. This is where a Jewish army captain was falsely accused of sabotage, whereas in reality the people who were responsible for collaborating with the Prussian enemy, the German enemy, were high-up members of the French army, but this Captain Dreyfus, who happened to be one of the rare Jewish army officers, was selected for being scapegoated simply because he was Jewish. Long story short, he was convicted, sentenced to a long-term imprisonment in Devil's Island, and forgotten about, except for a few leaders in the press, including the novelist Emil Zola, who wrote a beautiful editorial column called J'accuse, I Accuse, who charged the French government with a tremendous cover-up, tremendous conspiracy. Again, long story short, finally, under a new government, the Dreyfus case was reopened. He was exonerated, restored to his place in the army, made major, was promoted. But by that time, the damage was done. And there were people who still refused to believe that he was innocent in the first place. Those Jews must have gotten to the government. And so this whole Protocols of the Elders of Zion was a how-to-do-it list of how to take over all the institutions of the major governments of predominantly the Western world. And as you so correctly say, Fred, it's popped up all the time. I just read not too long ago that the heads of ISIS were utilizing the document. And in the 1930s, that document was presented by, I think it was Adolf Hitler himself, to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, which stirred up the Arab masses in Palestine as more and more Jewish settlers were trying to escape the impending doom of the Holocaust after Hitler took over. So this document, which is a total forgery and no truth in it whatsoever, was unfortunately and still is a tool in the toolbox of anti-Semites everywhere.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Dr. Sheldon Copperl is our guest. He's a professor at Grand Valley State University, and we're discussing anti-Semitism. Now, here is a question for you, Sheldon. Think about this. Now, you and I, both members of the board of Interfaith Dialogue Association, very active with Kauffman Interfaith Institute, we know that Islamophobia exists today, as does anti-Semitism. And we're both sympathetic to all of our wonderful Muslim friends and neighbors and interfaith colleagues who essentially want the same things we all do, to live in peace, to raise families in a friendly environment, all of that. We know this. Now, Islamophobia, however, is, I think, a little bit different from anti-Semitism in this, that aside from the fact that, yes, we sympathize greatly with our Muslim friends and all of the Muslims around the world who are caught up in violence that is foisted upon them, often by radicalized Muslims, we know that radical Muslims do exist. They're very dangerous. There are Muslims here in this country still, I'm sure, who would love to do you and me and our families great harm. It's just it's a fact, and there are Muslims around the world who share that same goal, to wreak destruction on not only non-Muslims, of course, but Muslims who aren't Muslim enough for their tastes. And so the challenge, of course, is to fight this vile force in our world, this extremely radicalized version of Islamism, while at the same time fully recognizing the humanity of most of the Muslims in this world. Okay, but still, as I say, there is this radical element that wants to do very, very evil things. And some people, of course, they're Islamophobic because they can't see the difference. A Muslim is a Muslim. A Muslim is violent because they're a Muslim, and the Quran tells them to kill other people, so that's what they think all Muslims want to do. I don't see any sort of comparison in Judaism. That is to say, yes, there are bad Jews, but there are not bad Jews that have all come together in various forces to try to destroy other countries. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. I can understand that.
Yeah, I mean, you had the Purple Gang, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, in Detroit. But you know, you also had Irish gangsters and Sicilian gangsters,
and we had Bugsy Siegel in Las Vegas.
You did, exactly, but that's not the same as ISIS. So I'm just curious, would you say that there is no great reason for the anti-Semitism that you experience as a child other than for theological reasons, not for the reasons of Jews getting together to either do violence upon people or to control the banks, to control the media, or anything like this?
I would think that even though there are a number of Jewish names affiliated with some of the movie-producing companies, with some of the banks, etc., there are also other non-Jewish names affiliated with them. Jews have always stressed education as an important way to better yourself in society. Back at the time when Jews were not able to become citizens, but the only thing they could do was learn. A lot of the learning was of the religious texts, and so we find lots of Jews in 19th and early 20th century Europe prior to the Holocaust attending yeshivas, schools that were set up for the study of the Jewish sacred texts, with very little concern for what we today would call the secular subjects. And that made the idea of learning, once Jews were allowed to attend universities, including some in the United States, where until fairly recently there were definite quotas on how many Jews could attend the Ivy League schools, for example, education became a high priority. So if Jews did well in the arts and in the business world and the economy, it was largely because these were things they were allowed to do. We also find that in science and medicine, there's a large number of Jews who have received Nobel Prizes and other similar awards. Lest you think that I'm being boastful and arrogant myself, I do want to point out that this is because, again, this is something that we as Jews have had emphasized. A similarity is the importance of education among many of our Asian American citizens and many of the students at Grand Valley, including a couple I just talked to today in my classes who happen to be Asian American, are very inquisitive and really anxious to learn. And there are many none of the above students are that way as well. But getting back to your point, and that is that, what was the point?
my opinion is that there is no radical Jewish sect, if you will, at least here in the United States, that is out to do anyone harm. And there is no cabal, there is no conspiracy.
Certainly not a conspiracy. Again, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is a myth. Jews are not out to bring down any peaceful government anywhere in the world, to my knowledge, certainly. There have been Jewish right-wing organizations during the Palestinian Mandate, and it's well known and to people who read the history that there were what we today should rightly call terrorists. Back in their days, they were freedom fighters from a Jewish point of view who were anxious to harass in any way possible, including killing of British troops. The King David Hotel in Jerusalem, for example, was housed British army troops, including some major officers, and some Jewish right-wingers bombed that hotel prior to the evacuation of the British when they turned the place over to the Jews and the Arabs. There have been right-wing movements within Israel, the Jewish Defense League, some of whose supporters do live here in America, but who, again, are trying to return tit for tat among some of the more activists on the other side. But in terms of any large-scale conspiracy, I don't see that.
No.
There's no worldwide Jewish conspiracy that I can think of.
No. I have to tell you, Shel, that one thing I just cringe every time I either hear it on radio or see it on television is when a reporter or an interview refers to an incident and then asks the guest, how did that make you feel? So I'm going to refrain from that, but I want to take you back a few weeks to when you saw on television a group of white supremacists chanting, Jews will not replace us. As opposed to telling me how you feel, because I could answer that question myself probably for you. But I'm wondering if seeing that opened your eyes to something that you didn't believe that you would ever see in your adult life, or did it spur you to some form of action that you might not have taken had you not seen that?
Well, it was scary because I frankly didn't think I would see it in the streets of an American college town like Charlottesville. And the fact that these people marched on a Friday evening past a synagogue with their chant, "Jews will not replace us," and chanting various Nazi slogans, including "blood and soil," that is not particularly an anti-Semitic chant, but marching with these swastikas and other signs of hate, and that they would do this past a Jewish synagogue so that the members of this temple, leaving the Friday evening Sabbath service, were urged by the members of the temple itself to leave through the back door and not confront these marchers. And then what, as a Jew, but as more of a believer in interfaith and the sacredness of other faith traditions, the fact that these marchers then went to a church where leaders of the clergy, the Christian community's clergy, were meeting and made a protest, a large protest there, to me is totally appalling. And it makes me more convinced and more proud of my Jewish heritage. Again, I think David Brooks was right in his column to say that there's nothing like this kind of display of hatred to make those who are targeted stick together more.
This is true. And one thing I have to say about what they were chanting, they were correct. Jews will not replace them. Robots will.
Well put.
So we are down to the wire for this this segment of Common Threads, Shel, but I want to thank you so much for your time, especially putting this into your schedule in such a last-minute way.
Well, it's my pleasure, Fred, and again, thank you very much for asking me to appear once again as a guest on your show. I hope I've made a small contribution to an understanding of the roots of anti-Semitism here in the United States.
Indeed you have. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and Dr. Sheldon Copperl from Grand Valley State University was my guest today. Please join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads.